Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. I'm the producer, Caleb Keith, and I'm joined by our hosts, Drs. Rod Rosenblatt, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Follow these great minds as they answer pressing questions about theology, history, and apologetics. This show is brought to you by 1517 The Legacy Project, serving to proclaim the gospel to all people, especially those broken by the church. Hello, everybody. Producer Caleb here, and I just have a couple announcements before the show begins this morning. First off, I just wanted to update everybody on how the push for donations, the podcasting campaign, is going. We're about a third of the way funded, so thank you everybody who has generously donated during this time and given to 1517 and the Thinking Fellows and the Virtue in the Wasteland podcasts. I just want to remind everybody that there's about a week and a half left, and so we still have two-thirds to go on that donation goal. We could still really use your help. If you haven't gone over to give.1517legacy.com yet, if you could please do that, maybe drop, you know, $20. You know, the original goal was 500 people at $20, and we have about 6,000 active listeners between Virtue in the Wasteland and Thinking Fellows. So it's definitely possible to still hit this goal in this last stretch. And again, thank you to everybody who's already donated and helped out. All right. Second on the agenda is there is an important event happening this weekend in Michigan. Dr. Scott Keith will be out in Michigan talking about his book, Being Dad, and fatherhood. In general, so the event's called Fatherhood, the Missing Link. It is on Friday, June 17th, from 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. It's at Emmanuel Lutheran Church in Cadillac, Michigan. I will post all that information in the show notes so that if you are out in Michigan, you can go see him. You can drive out. You know where you're going. It's a man's night, but it's open to men and women alike. It's going to have barbecue, live music, and lots of conversation on fatherhood there. And so Dr. Keith will also be out at Emmanuel Lutheran Church for a Bible study Sunday morning. So, you know, if you're in that area, this is a great opportunity to go see him. Most of our fans always talk about wanting to sit down with the fellows and record, and having Dr. Keith out there will be about as close to that as you can get at the moment. So I will put that in the show notes, and anybody out there will be able to go. All right, that's it for my announcements. Today we have a special episode with Pastor Paul Koch, so sit back, relax, grab a drink, and enjoy the show. Welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. Today we're doing a very special show, deviating from the Lochi a little bit. We have a guest with us, Pastor Paul Koch. He's a longtime friend of Dr. Keith. So, Dr. Keith, why don't you introduce Pastor Koch for us?
Well, Pastor Koch is pastor at Grace Lutheran Church, Ventura, California. A couple reasons he's on with us today. One, we've been good friends for a long time. Former student of Rod's, graduated from Concordia University in Irvine in 98, same year I did, same class as me. Big reason I want to have him on is at the end of the show, he's going to talk a little bit about one of our projects, Jagged Word. He'll tell us kind of the history of how that started since he runs that site for us and has been running it for, I think, 3 years now.
Yeah, coming up.
And the numbers are unbelievable.
Yeah, doing well.
It's doing well. Yeah, 3 years. But one of the reasons I wanted to have him on is our special episode today is going to be on preaching. And Adam said he'd rather go hang out with his son at the beach than talk about preaching. So we said, all right, sounds good. So number one, we had a microphone open. Number two, Paul is one of the best preachers I've ever heard. There's a lot of preachers. I go around to a lot of churches as I do traveling and lecturing and talking on being dad and things like that. And I hear a lot of preaching, some of it good, some of it bad, some content-wise, some lack some style. But at the end of the day, never myself, I never begrudge a guy for a lack of sort of, should we say, eloquence in preaching, as long as Christ crucified is being handed over.
Right on.
But Paul is one of those pastors, one of those rare pastors that seems to have been able to put it all together. We'll put in the show notes links up to some of his sermons. They're a great resource. When we do get the You Are Forgiven radio rolling along here, he'll be one of the featured preachers on You Are Forgiven radio, which will air on KKLA, and we're hoping in the next month or so.
All right.
But other than that, wanted to have Paul on. We're going to talk about preaching, and I wanted to start it out. I'm actually, even though Paul's a special guest, I'm going to throw the first question Rod's way and say, Rod, even on our show, you have said multiple times that if one of our listeners finds themselves in a church somewhere and they sit down and they make it through the service to the sermon, and during that sermon, Christ crucified is not preached, that they should get up and leave and go find another church.
Well, not necessarily get up and leave and walk.
Oh, did I add that?
Yeah.
No.
But it won't.
Okay, so stay through the service.
It won't be enough to sustain. The thing that sustains is Christ crucified at the heart of everything in a given parish. Ed, curriculum, pulpit, everything. So that if somebody comes, they say afterwards, man, if nothing else, that place is going to talk about the cross. No matter where you are in the parish or what you attend, it's somehow going to relate to Christ crucified. And that's what our parishes really should be like. The downside is, if you're in a church where the pastor believes that preaching Christ crucified is giving an altar call at the end of a lousy sermon, that's not preaching Christ. The altar call is not it. So we, in our service, will proclaim him in the verses of the liturgy, whether we like it or not, if we'll just use the hymnal. And in the Lord's Supper, it'll be put right to you. This is the real body of Christ given into death for you, Paul, or for you, Scott, or take and drink. This is the real blood of Christ shed for you and for your sins, Scott, or Paul, or Caleb. That is another way that we do it, but it's foreign to the evangelical. He thinks in terms of Christ being preached at a special service for unbelievers, which is wonderful. I wish we did more of that. But that's the category for him. And the question is, why would I need the gospel preached to me when it's already done its work and I've been converted? Mm. In other words, it's something that's without category for him. Mm. Why would you want to preach the gospel to me when it's done its work already? That needs to be addressed so that the Reformation is pushed up against it. That we actually still need the gospel often, well, regularly, or to put it another way, why do you go to church? Answer, to be absolved. To be absolved.
Right.
So what I'm saying to people is, you need that as much as I need it.
Right. I don't preach, right? So I'm not a pastor. I'm one of the smart aspects of today's show is to have two pastors and just somebody asking questions. But when I do this from, I guess what I'd say is a systematic category, what I can tell people is that the text is pretty clear that faith not only comes to us by the hearing of the gospel, Romans 1:16, Romans 10:17, First Corinthians chapter 1, many other places, but that same faith that comes to us initially in the preaching of the gospel that then converted me, that then justified me, that then made me a Christian, is that same faith that same preaching brings the faith again and again and again and again and sustains me in that faith.
Right.
Right. And so when somebody says, well, why would I need to hear that again if I've already been converted? Well, it's not like we think you're converted and reconverted and reconverted and reconverted.
Right.
But we all know that what we do all week in between church services just assails us. I mean, we are just again and again and again and again under attack by the devil, the world, and our own earthly flesh. And it's that gospel message again which revives, that faith in us and really sends us back out again into our particular vocations, fed and strengthened and kind of ready to go.
Yep.
And
we're believing something every single morning that's completely counterintuitive.
Right.
And I think that's part of what Luther meant by returning to your baptism. He meant other things, too.
But right, one I do, too.
One of the things was, you are going to need this because you're believing something that's so counter-intuition. It's got to be preached into your earballs because it's so counterintuitive.
Yeah, almost every Sunday you come in doubting what you heard the previous Sunday.
Yeah,
life has taught you to doubt it.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's or right. I come in and say, "Is the gospel great enough to even save a theologian?"
Right. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, just picking up on the context of what I've been lecturing on a lot lately on the book being dad, I think, is the gospel good enough even to save a dad who screws up all the time?
Right. Right,
you know, and you can apply that to any vocation, you know, that our listeners hold.
Yep.
Right, is the gospel even good enough to forgive this garage mechanic or this CPA or this whatever?
Right,
because all of our lives, it's not, you know, it's nothing unique about our particular vocations, as far as the fact that we are assailed, and you know, and it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So a couple themes kind of stood out to me as you were going, Rod, and one of them is that, and you, it was, I loved it. It was great when you were saying that we need to hear it used our names personally, and that, you know, you said you need to hear that, Scott. You need to hear that, Paul. You need to hear that, Caleb. That reminded me of something that I originally heard as taught from Gerhard Ferdy, which is this distinction between first order proclamation and second order proclamation. Can you hit that a little bit, Paul?
Well, yeah, so Ferdy, especially in his book, Theologies for Proclamation, right, makes this...
great book, by the way.
Yeah, incredible distinction of that proclamation. So he would say, I think, that in a sermon, there's a lot of things that go on. But one of the things that needs to go on is, or needs to happen is proclamation. And that is a first order, that is... I forgive you statement. It's something that can be rejected but not really argued with, right? So it's something that is being done to you. It's a speech act that is happening to you. So it's not, he has lots of ways of describing it. It's not a word about Christ or describing something of Christ, but it's rather doing Christ to the individual. That and that's that first order. You know, it's in a marriage ceremony when, you know, you ask the I do question, you know, will you take this man to be your husband? I do. That's actually, mm-hmm. no one can say that for that person, right? It's something is happening in the speaking of that word.
Mm-hmm. You said something I want to, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
yeah.
I hadn't heard it quite described that way, or hadn't thought about it. Maybe it's better to say I hadn't thought about it that way before. You said that it's something that you can reject, but you can't argue with. And I like that because
yeah.
it's sometimes hard to explain this idea of difference between first order and second order proclamation. And it's more like if I come into the room and say, I forgive you in the name of Christ,
right.
you can say, screw that.
I
reject that. but if I come in and so if the content in my sermon is you are forgiven in the name of Christ, that can be rejected. But if the content in my sermon is you ought to be nicer to your wife.
Right.
You know, I can say, well, she ought to be nicer to me
right.
first. Or have you met her? She's,
right.
you know,
right.
you know,
right.
you can kind of
yeah.
argue
yep.
with it all over the place.
Mark Jason does this with his evangelism work on college campuses where he told me the story of telling somebody walking by, you know, Jesus forgives you your sins. And he looks at him and he says, well, I don't want that. I don't care. And Mark goes, well, I don't care. It already happened, right? And it was like all you could do at that point was reject the word that is spoken. You can't kind of debate with it, right?
Uh-huh.
You can either say, no, I don't want it,
uh-huh.
But you can't say, I'm not a sinner. Or, you know, it's already, the word's already happened at that point, I guess.
Yeah.
yeah.
And that's something that I didn't get at either a liberal Lutheran seminary or a conservative one. Now, granted, I didn't take my homiletics there, but still, it wasn't a theme in class. What you're calling first order,
right.
it just wasn't at either place.
No, I didn't take homiletics anywhere, but it wasn't part of my theological education at all until Jim Nestegan and Aaron Peterson turned me on to reading Gerhard Ferdy.
Yeah.
And then it's pretty dominant theme in Ferdy, no matter what you read. Even if he's not systematizing it that same way, he'll talk about the personal declaration of forgiveness to the sinner.
Yep.
You know, and you know, if you've read Theologies for Proclamation, you'll know that he's referring to First Order Proclamation there.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right. So does this idea of First Order's, let me back up a second. First Order Proclamation is then important. Why?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it is the task of the preacher. I mean, you're actually fulfilling your calling at that point. You are there to, as Dr. Colby used to always tell us in class, he said, you are to be the hitmen and the midwives of God. You're to kill and make alive, right? So you're not there just to be the educators of God's people, but to do this act. And so...
Yep.
I think that distinction is important because it's so easy to slip into the second order of proclamation, second order speech acts, where you're describing these, you're talking about things, which are necessary and beneficial for
and
a life of faith.
Provide the setup for the first order declaration.
And they'll always be there. I mean, they kind of have to be. And but that it kind of says that's not at the end what you're doing. That's not the goal. That's not the end game.
Right.
You're moving towards something more.
Yeah, Dr. Horton will say to me sometimes when the microphones are off, when Reformed preaching goes south, our guys talk about the gospel.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you say when Lutheran preaching goes south?
South, right. Yeah, exactly.
Our guys
right.
will talk about the gospel.
Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that leads into, I think, a good question is, so where does sort of our classic method of looking at this law gospel preaching, you know, how does that tie into this first order, second order proclamation stuff? Because, I mean, is it possible to preach a second order gospel?
Gosh, I don't know what that would sound like.
So. What if you're just describing the historical facts?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in our Book of Concord, it's called Historical Faith.
Right.
And it's necessary but not sufficient, if I can use a philosophical phrase.
That's right. That's great.
That's good.
Yeah. The philosopher would say it's a necessary condition but not a sufficient one.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like seeing faith as those three parts, right? Knowledge, assent, and trust.
In a particular order.
In a particular order. And there's a lot of setup going there with knowledge and assent.
Yep.
But neither one of those actually saves, right? They're not sufficient to salvation, we say.
You can have you can be a Bible expert and not believe the gospel.
Right, yeah. But law gospel preaching, I mean, that's what we're known for, right? So how does that play out with this first order, second order stuff we've been talking about?
Well, I think it all, the law gospel distinction kind of, as categories, establish what we're... How would I say? They're the mode by which we accomplish what we're driving for.
And if we miss on it, we've missed the target.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I'd say even a second ago, you talked about the goal is to kill and make alive. So the law gospel distinction is the law is the killing and the gospel to making alive again. Right.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely.
If I that love got, that. That'd make a great T-shirt.
If that got loose in the Southern Baptist Convention. There'd be no stopping it.
Right. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, they'd evangelize the heck out of that.
It'd be what Rick Ritchie calls a time bomb. Yeah. You start using that category to understand the Bible, and your days as an evangelical are numbered.
Yeah. I want to, not to keep ripping off Gerhard Forty, but he's not a bad guy to rip off, I guess.
Yeah, Glory, I don't think he'd object.
Right. One of his were, I can't actually remember which one it was exactly. Maybe it was his commentary on the bondage of the will. But he talks about what happened in the gift of Christ was this explosion that went off. And he said, and what we've kind of done, we've set up camp in the crater. And we like to spend our days describing to people this great event. And he says what St. Paul does instead is say, no, you're going to go and you're going to start blowing it up again and again and again, right? You're not content just to describe this massive event, but to actually have it happen again and again in the lives of the people. And so law and gospel then I think, serves in a very focused way that exact idea. We're going to get to these people, and we're going to, you know, blow them up. we're gonna have this event happen for them in an intimate way.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, I think that is a good midway point there. So we'll leave for our break, and then we'll come back and finish up the episode. Welcome back from our break. Today, we're going to talk about another audio segment. This has been a trend. We've been hopping between books and audio during these breaks. But today, we're talking about a freebie, nothing from the store. And it's a classic work. It's Dr. Rosenblatt's The Gospel for Those Broken by the Church. This has had a lasting impact, this video / audio segment. And Dr. Keith, you're going to talk about, you know, perhaps why this came about or and who it's touched.
Well, Rod would have to answer why it came about. I think you did it at a conference that Dave Atkinson's Foundation put on at Concordia originally, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that's where it began.
Yeah. What was that? Oh, man. Why can't I remember that? Southern California.
Outreach,
yeah. Put on, and it was years ago, wasn't
yep.
it? Yeah.
Yep.
At Irvine, and it was... If you listen to it, it's kind of a classic Rod in about 50 minutes. So you kind of get, if you've spent any time around Rod or if you had a lot of classes with Rod, you've probably heard all that's in there in different pieces in different classes. And it's kind of like I say this too with the when good fathers die, it's always too soon. Is that there wasn't? I didn't hear anything new in that I hadn't heard before. But when I first heard that, I said, "We almost needed a different rating there, Caleb." I said, "Holy cow!" He finally systematized this thing. Like he finally put it down structurally and gave it as a talk. And the gospel for those broken by the church is, in my mind, it's that same thing, but it's to a much wider audience in a sense because. There are so many people out there that are broken by their experiences in church. Now, we've gotten occasionally, quote unquote, in trouble for you suggesting that the church might break people. But I guess having listened to this particular lecture many times, I'd say what you're saying there is that they've had particular experiences in church with particular people that have absolutely broken them to the idea of church. And you use two categories of people who were once Christian, mm-hmm. who for whatever reason walked away from the church, and that as they've walked away, as you encounter them, you say they're sad former Christians and mad former Christians. In other words, sad former Christians who were broken by something that happened to them in the church, and they're gone, and they're sad that they're gone.
Yep.
They just don't feel safe going back.
Yep.
Right? And the same thing with the mad ones. If something happened or a series of things happened and they felt it necessary to walk away from the church, and as you encounter them, now they're just pissed off,
yep.
right? And they're not going back because they feel very justified in their anger. And what the gospel for those broken by the church describes is the reality of what Christianity is. Because I think, I don't want to mischaracterize what you said, but if I recall it correctly, what you say is that most of those people, when you encounter them, they haven't rejected Christ
That's right.
as much as they've rejected the institution church. Of the church.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep. Yep.
Or the conception of Christianity that their particular church was presenting to them,
yep.
which probably wasn't actually Christianity.
Usually law, gospel, law.
Right. Yeah, and so what you do in that lecture, just very eloquently, is you describe the reality that they are saved on account of Christ alone.
Yeah.
You give them historic Christianity.
Yeah. If there were a title assigned to it other than one I assigned to it, it'd be Sola Fide.
Right, right.
And that no matter what the church is doing to you, Christ isn't doing it to you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we advertised that one today because we always try to link something, some resource on our site to the episode that we're going after. And we don't like have a a book on preaching published yet with us, but we do the Gospel for Those Broken by the Church very much lays out the message that is first order proclamation that ought to be happening from the pulpit every Sunday, pretty much without fail, if possible, right? And so go ahead and take a look at that. I would say it is
gone out but more than anything else we've done here.
At the risk of making Rod blush, it's made Rod famous. So really, when I've gone to several conferences with Rod now, and people know him from that address, also, of course, from your years on White Horse Inn, but from that address particularly, and the number of people that I have personally witnessed come up to Rod and say, that message changed my life, and in reality, it brought me back into the church, which I always find a bit ironic for the people that get pissed off at you for assigning it that title to the thing, because the people I've encountered that have heard it and are just thrilled at it are people that were outside of the church, possibly outside of the faith, and then heard that, and then all of a sudden reoriented their life so that getting into a congregation where Christ is preached became the most seminal part of their life. And I think, wow, I mean, what a blessing. You know, God has worked through that and through the proclamation and the gospel in that message to actually engender and re-engender and ignite faith in the hearts of people.
Part of that is 15 years with InterVarsity on various campuses throughout Southern California, then being at Westmont and watching the burnouts begin, and having grown up in Lutheran Pietism, it wasn't a long jump to say, I know what's going on in you. I grew up in that stuff, and it'll kill you.
And it's gone on in me. One of the things you were able to say.
Well, I think I said in there, you might realize or you might recognize that this isn't too hard for me right now, and it isn't.
Right,
but the thing is that sort of confusion is not Christ. One of the parts I do is just lay out wonderful promises with no requirement, just verse after verse after verse after verse. You know, be of good cheer, little flock. It's your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. You know, just verse after verse after verse after verse.
Makes me want to listen to it again.
Right. It does.
But that isn't what they were getting in their parishes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Or another way I phrased it, I said, most of us, any kind of Christian is going to say, the gospel of Christ is sufficient to save sinners. Then if you ask later on, is the gospel of Christ sufficient to save believers? Then all of a sudden the room divides. And I'm going to take the side, the gospel's enough to save failing believers. And everybody perks up their ears and says, I've never heard anything like that before.
Yeah, Jim Nestegate will say it slightly differently. He says, if Christ saves, then nothing else does. Period, the end. I mean, you know, those people that are outside, those people that are inside, if Christ saves, nothing else does. And so the reality is that we can try to convince ourselves that there's some sort of dichotomy between those people that are outside and those people that are inside. But at the end of the day, if we are saved, it's because we rely on Christ alone.
Yeah, I think back to the number of times I read books or booklets from the evangelical sphere, good ones, InterVarsity, old InterVarsity, and you'd have the categories of sinners and Christians.
Jeez.
And I'd go, holy smokes, man. You know, don't talk like that.
Yeah, don't talk like that. Sinners who are Christians.
Yeah.
Christians who are sinners.
Yeah.
All right.
So if you want to listen to that, the easiest way to get to it will, as always, be in the show notes. There's a link in the show notes. If you don't listen on a podcasting app that has the show notes in it, if you just Google the Gospel for Those Broken by the Church, the first thing that comes up is the 1517 website, with that available to watch in your browser or download as an MP3 file. And so that's available for free to all people. You can even, if you have a website, there is a section on here that says how you can post that on your own website without. All you have to do is just give us credit for it, and it's yours
addressed,
to use.
It's addressed to those who now see themselves as alumni of the Christian Church.
That's interesting. I was just up in Oregon, Klamath Falls. I did two presentations. being dad on Saturday night and secondary confirmation on Sunday morning, both of which I think both of you guys have heard. And I know Caleb's heard it. One of the things I discuss in secondary confirmation is the reality that in the Lutheran Church, we have a particular phenomenon that we create so many alumni at confirmation.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, at 12, 13 years old.
Yep.
And they too, I mean, I cannot tell you how many, the last time I was up in San Francisco and I did that men's sports fellowship sports outreach, I was driving to the venue and there were two people in the back of the church just railing on Lutheranism, or in the back of the car, just railing on Lutheranism. And I'm not the guy that's going to, you know, come defend the church.
Sure.
But it just got kind of brutal. And after a while I said, you know, just out of curiosity, what was your experience with Lutheranism? And both of them said that they had bad experiences with law, gospel, law. They didn't describe it that way because they're now like steeped in evangelicalism. But if I could translate for them, law, gospel, law, preaching, and that their confirmation class was the last thing they experienced because they left after confirmation. You know, I call it graduation at confirmation. Yep. And at that point, at 12 or 13, whatever, they had not heard the consistent message of their redemption on account of Christ. And I thought, wow, it's just, we think... I guess one of the things I'd say, we refer to evangelicals a lot on this show, and I think we, LCMS Lutherans particularly, can tend to think that we're immune from that type of thing, and we're just not.
No.
I mean, if we get outside of our circles, it's amazing how many people you meet that are now outside of our circles who were formerly in the circle, and they have very particular reasons why.
Yep.
And oftentimes it has to do with what they were hearing on Sunday morning.
Yep.
So, anyway.
Yeah.
As a lead-in, hey, we had a great little introductory conversation as we went to the break, and when Paul was done, we cut off, and Rod said, you know, some of this talk from Ferdy about the reoccurrence, you know, that you go out and you create the reoccurrence of the event makes you a little bit nervous. Why don't you, I thought it'd be good for us to hash that out a little bit on air.
Well, I grew up in the heyday of Neo-Orthodoxy when my whole synod was turning left, but it's hard to do this without, we're limited by language. I don't want to say what any real priest who knows Trent is going to say, that somehow in his own hands he's re-crucifying Christ in an unbloody way. No, 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 no. But then again, on the other side, I don't want to use the phrases of Protestant neo-orthodoxy or worse, liberalism, because they've been ground so badly. What we want to get across is that the gospel goes to an individual brain and an individual heart and gets absolved. It's difficult to do that. Even using the Philosophical Speech Act, that's as close as I can see we can get to it. But it's hard with language to say, no, I'm not redoing anything. I'm just trying to tell you that this is not a lesson in history.
Right. If I could... I don't mean to clarify Ferdy, but if I could maybe do so a little bit.
Then again, my quote of Ferdy could be wrong. So.
Yeah, well, I don't actually think it is. I just think it's it's incomplete. I guess I'd say contextually incomplete. But if I could do that through Jim, I would say what I think I have read in Ferdy is not so different than you calling the gospel the dynamite of salvation.
Yeah, there you go.
Right? You know, when you quote Romans 1:16, and you say, hey, the gospel is the dynamite of salvation. And that's a vivid memory for me because every time you would say that, you'd either pound on a desk or smack your hands together like that. And that there's an actual something that's happening there. That dynamite is exploding in the heart of the believer, and an actual crater is resulting after that, just like the original one. It's not, I don't think Ferdy is saying that the actual death of Christ in a historical fashion happens again.
No, surely not.
Surely not. I think what he's talking about is just that there is, that the gospel is actually powerful. I was just having this discussion with the pastor who was kind enough to have me up to Oregon, Jacob Scott, who I think is going to really love hearing his name on Thinking Fellows, having this discussion with Jacob Scott. And I said, you know, the funny thing is we get into these weird conversations in the LCMS about law and gospel and antinomianism and all that. But one of the things we have to remember is just the numerous promises that are attached to the preaching of the gospel. Yeah. Almost every time it's described, especially by Paul, even by Christ, what's attached to it is this word power.
Yeah.
Right? This idea that the gospel proclamation is a powerful thing.
Dunamis.
Yeah. It just does stuff. And that's how I say it to the kids at Concordia. Like, when God speaks, stuff happens. And the gospel proclamation is God speaking and stuff is happening. Explosions are going off. Craters are being created. Faith is being engendered and strengthened, and it's just an amazing miracle.
Yeah.
And we talked about that a little bit last time when we were discussing baptism, the miraculous nature of the power of the gospel.
Yeah.
All right. Good. So, Paul, I'm going to put you on the spot here. At the beginning of the show, I said you're a very good preacher. I noticed you didn't blush at all or shy away from that. personality, but at the end of the day, what would you say if I forced you to answer this question? I'm going to I'm holding the whiskey. What makes a good preacher?
Oh, that is a big question. I think at the end of the day, a good preacher is one who maybe first of all believes he has authority to do what he is sent to do. That work of killing and making alive is actually what he's there to do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that often, for me, that's been definitive for me. And it wasn't there initially when I first was ordained. I was pastor and you're kind of fumbling along trying to figure this thing out. And to come to that realization that, you know, there's a lot of things that go on to being a pastor. The running of a congregation in many ways and business affairs and all the programs that are happening and all the people that you're visiting and that. But at the end of the day, you are there to speak a definitive word into the lives of these people.
An absolving
them, yeah. And that's, that again, that death and life is happening. And so I think if I share a little bit, I when I went to the seminary, and actually it's great to be here with you two. Both Scott and Rod were crucial in sending me off to the seminary. When I got there, I wasn't really sure I wanted to be there. I love theology. The idea of preaching terrified me. Still terrifies mm-hmm. me in a respect. But I remember standing that very first, they do a big kind of gathering at the president of the seminary's house, and you're standing out there, you're drinking beer, you're having a good time. And I heard this guy behind me, another brand new student, saying he couldn't wait till he could preach.
Yeah.
And I thought, that is insane. Yeah. That's the last thing in the world I want to do, right? That's the responsibility is too much. The weight is too, you know, I don't want that, you know. I thought maybe we'll just go on. We'll see how this plays out kind of thing. And later on, it became when I was ordained and I was called by this congregation, they were asking me to do something very specific to absolve them. That is exactly what, I mean, Rod, you're right. I mean, that's what it is. And so that you're there, you know, again, to go back to Kolb's quote, to be the hitmen and midwives. You're there to kill them and to bring them alive with the word of the Lord. And so I think that at the heart of it is what makes a preacher a good preacher.
If we had guys, even in our own church, doing them in every town and burg, Scott said, not necessarily eloquently.
Yeah, right, right.
It would change everything.
It takes a one of the complaints I'll hear from time. It's not really a complaint, but I'll hear from time to time is that my preaching is bold. Right. Now I take that as a compliment.
Yes.
But I think their initial reaction is you're just kind of saying things. And the only reason I say them is because I actually believe that that is my vocation to say right, those yeah. things.
Yeah.
And so I kind of don't shy away from it, to call the sin a sin, to smash them with the law,
mm-hmm.
and then to set them free mm-hmm. with every ounce of my being that I can muster.
I used to hear over and over again, either directly or indirectly, well, does that mean you're preaching the same sermon 52 Sundays a year? Answer, not at all. Not really at all. Well, why? Well, because there's so many texts in the gospel that if you do your homework, you know, on what your particular text is for that Sunday, then you're going to do that text faithfully with Christ as the center, especially in his dying, and you're going to do it with law gospel.
Right.
But there are a zillion texts in the Bible.
Right.
There's where the variety comes from.
Right. Yeah, the variety comes from, all those wonderful texts to kind of to do the same thing, though, week in and week out. I mean, the goal
find Christ.
Right, is the same. Yeah.
That's good. So we don't usually do, like I said, practical stuff on this show. All that I don't know what that even means. But we don't provide lists.
Mike calls it practically theology.
Yeah, we don't usually provide lists, right?
Right.
Prescriptive type things. But again, I've been thinking about doing this show for a long time. I just happened to be up in Ventura on Wednesday. I happened to know that maybe you were coming down for the board meeting tonight.
Right. Yep.
And I happened to say, if you are coming down, let's do this show. And so I've been kicking it around with pastors. What would you need to hear? And believe it or not, they want some advice on even like sermon prep. Is there any advice that you guys like? That's hard for me. I did some of that for a while, but it's not my career. And it is for you. So is there any? I know you have a process. I know you well enough to know you're a process guy.
Right.
And I think people that only sort of know you tangentially probably don't know that about you and wouldn't expect that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But you're very much a process guy.
Yeah. In most of my life, I am not a process guy. Mm-hmm. And I think the fear of the vocation makes me one with regard to preaching. So most things I'm pretty free and loose on, but when it comes to preaching, I have kind of stuck with a process. And I think it will change. It is different. I talked to obviously a lot of pastors and when you actually get to the conversations of preaching, which unfortunately doesn't happen nearly as much as the average layperson probably assumes we talk a lot about these things, and we don't.
Yep.
And that's sort of troubling in and of itself. But when we do, guys have different processes. For me, it's very structured. So I stick with the speech act theory stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask questions of, you work through a text, you translate a text, you kind of, okay, this is one I'm going to preach on, and then you actually nuts and – is that where you want you on? Nuts and bolts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
all right, nuts and bolts. What I do then is I ask really two essential questions. I ask, what is the illocutionary aspect of this text? That is, what does this text count as? That is it a – is it a warning? Is it an assertion? Is it encouragement? Is it a promise? I mean, what is the text that I'm actually dealing with?
Right,
and you get to this kind of central, and I actually write it out. Like, this text counts as, and I write, I make myself write it out.
Like by hand.
Yeah, by hand. I do. Yeah, I get a little journal and I write it out. Yeah.
It's your process.
It's my process. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I ask the perlocutionary aspect. What does this text call the hearers to do? Right? Is it? What does it want them to do? Maybe that's so. Is it to trust, to believe, repent? I mean, and these will change by what text you have.
Sure.
And then from that, then I glean what then is the goal of my sermon I'm going to craft. If it is a textual sermon, it should flow from those two questions. In other words, if the text I have is a text of encouragement and it's calling the people to trust in like last Sunday, trust in the teaching of one God and three persons, that kind of thing, then I would want my sermon to at least, maybe at least to begin with, at least go focus in those ways. So it's a it's a faithful proclamation of the word to the text that I'm preaching. The text is guiding then what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I heard from somebody much wiser than I, he said, when I'm at a church and hearing a sermon, one of the things in the back of my mind is always, could this have been easily preached in a Mormon church?
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would ask, my follow-up to that would be, when you're going through the perlocutionary sections there, and you're saying what is the text asking?
Yeah.
Do you have the assumption in the back of your mind that God's word, when it requires something, it also provides what is required? So you're saying it's asking something of my parishioners,
right. Given to you in Jesus' death,
right? Yeah, right.
And it's given to you, and you're assuming that because I've heard you preach. I mean, the reality is that I don't walk out of there with a to-do list. What I walk out of there with is a to-done list.
To-done
list. Nice.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yeah. So you're if it's to trust in something, so you're saying that the gospel itself is providing this.
Yes.
So you're getting, that's where you're getting to, and that's where then proclamation itself proper, that first order proclamation, is going to come in. I mean, it's where it has to come in.
That's great. One of the things you left out, and I just happen to know this because we talk about this stuff all the time,
right,
is the fact that every Tuesday morning, what do?
Yeah, I meet with a group of guys in Newbury Park, actually. They probably listen, so they'll be glad I mentioned
them. Name. They're going to
it's Tim and Matt and Jonathan. It used to be Bob Hiller. He's now moved on to another congregation. But and we translate. So we begin with the text every week. And we work through the Greek and Hebrew to the best of our abilities, and that process and the conversations we have around the text then drives what we do. It's funny, people ask me, "Well, do you lay out like a sermon series?" And I don't. Mm-hmm. Me personally, I show up Tuesday morning, and I most of the time have no idea what the assigned readings are, and I open my little agenda and I find them, and I go, well, okay, it's these ones, and we work through them. And in that process, I'll decide this is what needs to be proclaimed this Sunday, this text.
I don't know. Yeah. And I mean, I've told you this before, but and Rod and I talk about this stuff all the time. I cannot tell you how necessary I think that is for a couple of reasons. One, of course, it's important to be in the original languages of the text, mm-hmm. to know,
right.
you know, context and actual meaning and stuff like that. But you know, you're doing what we talk about doing is necessary all the time for guys generally, is you're finding a reason to get together as a group of guys and just be a group of guys together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And pastors need that.
Yes.
As I go out all over the country, what I can tell you is that many Lutheran pastors feel absolutely alone.
Yep.
And they feel absolutely alone.
And that was truly a gift for me. When I was first pastor down in Georgia, I was installed, and this guy handed me his card, and he said, "We're meeting here this Tuesday." Great group of guys, and they took me in immediately. And so when I came back out, when I got my call here to California, I went and sought it, and I found guys, and I kept bugging people till guys met. Now, you know, now it's a long affair. We translate, then we go get, it's Taco Tuesday, we get tacos, we have a few drinks at the bar, we talk, and that camaraderie around the word, around our vocation is indispensable. And
yep.
I don't know if I could do without it, to be honest.
That's amazing.
I wish everybody knew that.
Yeah.
We're not meant to be alone as men.
Right.
Yeah. So before Caleb starts telling me we're out of time, I have one more thing to say. Maybe we'll go long for the first time ever.
No. Two episodes ago.
Okay.
We went pretty long.
Paul, you're one of the first Lutheran pastors that I've actually heard self-describe as a preacher. Why is that?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier is that I think at the end of the day, that is the vocation of a pastor, is to be a preacher. There's a lot of things that go on. Anyone who is a pastor, anyone who's been hung out any time in a church office knows the amount of mail and things that come in for all the various things we can do and spend our time on. But I think really the bulk of our time needs to be on this this point, this the proclamation of the word, that this is what you're there for. This is that absolution, as Rocky's bringing up, is what you're there for. And so I think keeping that as the focus helps to say, first of all, time management, this is where I'm putting my time.
Sure.
And then as even things like as I read, as I study, other things, that is bending towards this goal to be better and better at this task. When I think of the I remember Montgomery's old text, The Theologian's Craft, which was powerful for me when I was going to seminary. I kind of take it as a pastor now to that next level, that I think my craft is to be a preacher. And so I work hard, I try to anyway, to continue to develop that, that it's never just good enough, or it's never just simple enough, that it's always, we're always working at it.
That's great.
Well, so much. You couldn't say what you just said unless the focus was on also the what that you're preaching.
Right.
Because we've got thousands of guys who are excited, not my our church, but I mean in a broader way, but it's not focused at all on Christ and his dying. Not really. That gets reduced to an altar call. What you're talking about is, I have got to give these people death by the law and Christ afterwards, you know, to give them life and resurrection and salvation and justified before God for free.
Yep.
Outside of our circles, that's kind of weird. It is.
Yeah.
It's kind of weird.
All right, I got one more question, and then we'll get Caleb off my back
here.
Oh,
my.
One more question. So the other thing I was asked is, would you recommend that our listeners who want to develop the, in themselves the craft of preaching, for them to read anything in particular? We've mentioned time and time again, theology is for proclamation.
Yeah.
Is there anything else?
Well, that's a great – I mean, you got your standards, of course, the proper distinction by Walther. You know, those things are standard. Ferde for me was a kind of a game changer. And then I went on and I read Wingren's The Living Word.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating, great text. Yeah. And I just got a copy of...
To be accused of several things.
From I know, that's all right. I just got a copy of, and I've read about halfway through, Feasting and a Famine of the Word, which is a new publication, just came out as several authors, young, a lot of them younger, but I know Paulson's in there, a few other guys.
Paulson's a phenomenal preacher.
Yes.
Is he?
And he's,
that doesn't surprise
his work, a lot of his work, Categorical Preaching, is one of his great essays.
That's right.
So there is a lot out there.
There's a lot of junk.
And actually, outside of that, I've read a lot of just standard rhetoric works. I don't know how popular that is. When I talk about it, I get a lot of glassy-eyed looks from some of my colleagues.
Nobody loves to read. Nobody thinks they love to read the classics.
But I think some of that, or a lot of that, I kind of view, again, I think Montgomery had said that, we're kind of, as an apologist, you're removing intellectual boundaries, right, from people. You're kind of John the Baptist making the way straight sort of thing, or you're insisting that in essence... In a sermon these days, where people's attention spans are so much shorter, it's a lot harder, that I think good rhetoric functions that way. In other words, you're removing boundaries from which people are going to tune you out anyway. So you're trying to find time proven ways to continue to hold their attention, to bring them back, so that they can receive that word as it kills and makes it live. You know, that they're not, you know, making shopping lists or something while they're sitting in the pews.
This isn't necessarily a preaching text, but I know as a layman, I want my pastors to read Bogaert's Hammer of God at least once a year.
Sure.
Mainly because what Garrett goes through, and he does it through story, which I love anyway, what he does there is he's describing the conversations that the parishioner needs in those times of crisis, those times of greatest need, at death, at sickness,
And he's taking on whole movements.
Oh, he's taking on a whole movement through story, which, I mean, talk about talent. I mean, that's just amazing. So, anyway, do you have any, Rod, that you'd throw in there?
I don't think I can add anything better, but you've picked out some of the best. My stress is always on that deep down Christ-centered, cross-centered, blood-centered content. And even if you don't say it wonderfully and eloquently well, do that as if your life depended on it, because in many ways it does. Get Christ and his benefits across, even if it's stumbling.
Right.
Right.
And it's not bad, in my opinion, for pastors to work on their elocution from the pulpit.
Right.
I mean, it's just not.
Yeah, people used to say to me...
The people in the pews, we appreciate that.
Yeah. Sure. Right, yeah. Sure. I had people say to me, gee, you're a marvelous speaker. I said, it's only on one subject.
That's right. The one that matters, though. Yeah. So you're
they were imagining that I had trained in speech or something. I said, no. It's just this one subject I'm consumed with.
Right. Well, politics and guns, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, title of this episode, Caleb, has to be "You Are Called to Be the Hitmen and Midwives of God."
Oh, you got it, sir.
I mean, it has to be
written down.
And then we're going to throw it for our last sort of commercial break back over to Paul to talk about Jagged Word. But I want to ask our listeners to please.
Whoa.
There's a bee in the studio.
It's
just a bee. You all right?
I paused it.
I want to ask our... you pause it. Because you're going to run like a girl?
I'm like sitting there and I'm climbing my paw.
Killed out the door.
I hate nothing more than being stung by a bee.
Well, that's true.
All right. Didn't play. Okay. You're good. Now.
Now I have to cough.
I'm going to cut this section anyways. There you go. Yep. Mm-hmm.
I want to ask our listeners to head over to iTunes and review us over there, because that it may sound self-serving, but it's actually important for people's ability to find us on iTunes. I mean, the more we're reviewed, the better we're reviewed, the easier it is for people to find the Thinking Fellows over at iTunes. So if they could go do that, we'd appreciate it. We're not going to offer prizes or anything like some people I know out in podcast land. But we will do that. All right. So, Caleb, what's next?
All right. Well, I was hoping Paul could talk about the Jagged Word and perhaps its inception and what it is now. Three of us at the table write for it. So
Right. So the Jagged Word is thejaggedword.com is the blog I started. Oh. Well, I guess it'd be 4 years this September, right? Is that right? 3 years?
I don't know.
Years?
The way I can do that is I can go back to our original posts and see when they were.
But the numbers are phenomenal.
Yeah, we always shock ourselves. So it started when I first talked to my wife. Said, I think I'm going to start a blog. I knew nothing about blogging. I still don't really know a lot, but it was. She said, "Why are you doing this?" Because that was the last thing I needed was something else.
We have five children. I need your
help. Yeah, I have five. Yeah, right. So why do this? And it was kind of, I would go to pastors' conferences and very passionate specifically about preaching. And I said, you know, I'm just kind of tired of being ignored. You know, let's make some ruckus. Let's cause people to kind of take notice. And then realized quite right away that I can't do this myself at all. A good blog needs multiple authors to continue to give good content. I asked Scott's right away, and you were in the midst of dealing with students and all that wonderful world.
I was kind of pissed off.
Yeah, you were an angry guy back in the day, and so Scott teamed up with me, and then we started adding really just friends of mine who I had kind of lost contact with. We'd see each other occasionally or talk occasionally, but that are pastors, most of them all over. And we've added various authors throughout the years to talk about different kind of narrowed focus. But the idea is to have that free exchange, that free kind of conversation of I mean, life and theology, church. Bob Vocation. Hiller writes about sports. I mean, we've kind of got topics that hit all over the place.
Bob Hiller writes about the gospel through the means of sports.
Yes, he does. And yeah, so, and so it's it's kind of it's interesting. I have, you know, friends of my parents now who will comment on, because they love Bob's stuff because they're sports folks, and there's Bob bringing the gospel through conversations of current sporting events and things. And so it's been fun. It has changed, to be sure, over the years, and will continue to do so. What it is now really has far surpassed what I ever thought it would be to start with. We like that. We have a lot of fun. We get in trouble sometimes, and we're kind of okay with that, and we don't really mind that. As long as guys are still kind of riding and going. We've go out to the seminaries for their symposias. We like to throw a party for the students, not for the powers that be or the alumni returning, but rather the students that are currently there, that they can come and just have a good time, kind of no strings attached. So we do that kind
we
of stuff.
We had a great showing last year at St. Louis.
Yeah.
About 60 people.
Yeah, and so we...
Terrific.
We look to do that again. And again, really no strings attached. Just come. And the idea is... Ross Engel, who's one of our writers, and he kind of does
who's writing more lately,
yes.
And is blowing me away.
Yeah, he's doing good stuff.
A-N-G-L-E.
Yeah. And he you know, as he always says, the idea is that when men get out there, that they remember that they're not alone, and that if they don't have that group right around them, that there's folks like us out there that are willing to hear them out, and even write. Every now and then I'll get submissions from kind of out there in internet world. We've only done a few of those, but you know, if it's a way for them to participate in the conversation. So
I'm showing your first post as September 21st, 2013.
Yeah, it sounds right. Yeah, 2013. Yeah, so this September we'll be in St. Louis for our 30-year anniversary, I guess.
We will. It'll be our third trip to St. Louis.
Yeah.
I think I'm actually going to take the plane from Frankfurt to St. Louis, because otherwise it'll be Frankfurt to Los Angeles, a day home, Los Angeles to St. Louis.
Right.
So I think I'll just go to St. Louis. Great.
All right. I'll link the Jagged Word in the show notes. It's been there before, but anybody new listening to the show can find it. Anybody else listening? Dr. Keith already talked about... giving us a review. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter if you want to follow us.
Thinking Fellows website.
And the Thinking Fellows website, which by the time you're listening to this has been completely overhauled and looks amazing. So go ahead and check that out. See you next time. Bye.
Bye.
All right.